Shall we go ahead and go over the answers for these? Let's start on the middle one first, because that's going to be the simplest of the problems, most likely. So how many stereocenters are there actually on that molecule? Well, how many places does it even look like there might be the possibility of having stereocenters on the molecule? Well, you might be led to think there's two because you see dashes or wedges on two positions. But remember that any time that you have two or more of the same substituent on one position, that means that at least locally you could draw a mirror plane through that position, which means that that position itself is not a stereocenter. So the bottom of the molecule where you have the two methyl groups, not a stereocenter. But up top, the way we can figure out if it's a stereocenter or not is figure out if you do have four unique kinds of attachments. So we have a hydrogen and deuterium, which are different from each other. And then we have the ring itself. But the ring at that position is not symmetric. If you were to go clockwise from the deuterium, it's just two positions away to get to those methyl groups. But from the other direction, one, two, three, four positions away, that means that there's a difference between the chains. And remember how the priority rules work, where first it's atomic number, and then there's a sub-rule where if you can't determine between atomic number, then you look at mass number. So that's how we make deuterium more important than hydrogen. But then if you can't determine the priority from the first place that you're looking at, from the position right at the stereocenter, then you've got to go one more position out. So following that logic, going one position away, either direction, you hit the same thing. A carbon that's got two hydrogens and then more of the ring. But go one more position out and you get to the methyl groups first going clockwise. So that's going to make that part of the ring priority number one. The other part of the ring priority number two, because carbon is more important than any form of hydrogen. Deuterium is a higher mass number than hydrogen, so it's priority three. Hydrogen itself is priority four, and it's already oriented in the back of the plane, which is the way you're supposed to orient it when you're visualizing whether it's R or S. Since the substituents are arranged in a clockwise order, this is R. Now let's go back to the first molecule. How many stereocenters on this one? Yes. Right. The right-hand stereocenter, what did you get for that configuration? Oh, okay. Okay. Did you do the first molecule? No. Anybody in this room do the first molecule? Oh, my gosh. Well, let's do it together then. The right-hand stereocenter, the simpler one. We have oxygen, carbon, carbon, hydrogen that are attached. Oxygen, higher atomic number, so it's going to be priority number one. Then it's not automatically the longest chain that matters, but if you're considering that you have just a methyl group, just one carbon sticking out there, or you have a carbon chain of any longer length, that's going to automatically take precedence over a methyl group. So the longer carbon chain is priority two, methyl group number three, hydrogen, yet again, oriented properly for visualization in the back. We again have the substituents ordered in clockwise fashion, so that stereocenter is, again, R. Now let me rewrite the molecule so I don't clutter this up any more than I have, so we can do the other stereocenter. Because it's not exactly a trick problem, but you might have been tempted to say, oh, well, this chain's got two alcohols on it, so it must be more important than the chain that's only got one alcohol on it. But that's not how the priority rule works. You look at each atom as you go one step further and further away from the stereocenter until you find the first place where there's something different. So if we do look at that first position, away from the chlorine. We have carbon and carbon. And on the left-hand carbon, attached to it is a carbon, a hydrogen, and a hydrogen. The right-hand carbon, it's a carbon, a hydrogen, and hydrogen that are attached to. And remember that when we're listing these priorities, I don't refer back to where we came from, because that's going to be the same for everything that's attached to. Since I can't tell a priority difference between these two, they're both CHH, I got to go one more position out, and I follow the most important substituent from that position, which in this case is carbon. So I'll go to the next carbon out. On the left-hand side, what do I have attached? Another carbon and two hydrogens. But on the right-hand side, I have an oxygen, a carbon, and a hydrogen. So because that oxygen happens first, even though there's only one oxygen, it happens earlier in the chain. So according to the first point of difference, we now are going to give that right-hand chain the higher priority. So chlorine's highest priority because it's higher atomic number. The chain with the closer oxygen is priority number two. The chain that happens to have more oxygens but they're further away, that's priority three. Hydrogens in back, this is S. Questions about the three stereocenters we've done so far? Yeah. So this one?
No, that one.
That one?
Yeah.
Okay, so oxygen's priority one. If we looked at what's attached at the carbons that are up there, on the right-hand side, it's hydrogen, 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 because it's a methyl group. On the left-hand side, it's carbon, hydrogen, hydrogen. Since carbon's more important than hydrogen, the left-hand chain is more important than the methyl group. The way I said it the first time is that if you have a methyl group where you've only got one carbon in the first place, or if you've got any other longer chain, then automatically, because you're going to have a longer chain, that next point of attachment is going to be more important than the hydrogens on the methyl groups. So if you have a methyl group and anything more complicated than a methyl group, in that case, you can kind of shortcut and say, well, the methyl group's going to be less important. Now, what about the last case, though? The double bond. We haven't seen a case like that yet before. Yeah, sure. Right here?
Yeah.
Not a stereocenter, though, because you've got two of the same group that are attached. So since you've got the two OHs, and you'll notice sometimes I'll write molecules that do have stereocenters, but I'll use plain lines. We're going to see that later on today, in fact. And in those cases, you wouldn't be able to tell if it's R and S, and often if you're writing a structure that way, it's on purpose. You either don't know whether it's RS that you're dealing with, or it doesn't matter that it's RS that you're dealing with. In this case, though, even if I had dashes and wedges, this would be one of those trick question type things. It's two of the same substituent, not a stereocenter. Now, for the double bond, we have to rewrite it somehow, because notice that everything we've done so far has been comparing things that have single bonds. So there is a systematic way to handle that double bond, and it's using what are called phantom or virtual atoms. Some texts use one term, some texts use the other. As a simple example, let's take this aldehyde. What you do is you look at one bond, or one atom that's on the double bond, and you see what it's doubly bound to. To show that it's got this double connection, rewrite it as a single bond, but then make a new single bond to a copy of that same atom. That sounds more complicated when you say it, but I'll just write it out and you'll see what results. So the carbon, it's double bonded to oxygen. So you show the bond to oxygen, but then you write another oxygen in. From oxygen's perspective, it's connected to carbon, so we've got that bond back to carbon. But to show that it's really got a double connection, you put another carbon on there. So you're doubling the bond, again, from each atom's perspective. Those extra atoms I've written in are these virtual or phantom atoms. So when determining the priorities of double or triple bonds, rewrite them using the phantom atoms to then determine which one has that highest first difference point. So when determining priorities of double or triple bonds, the bonds are rewritten as multiple single bonds. Using phantom atoms. Yes.
If the double bond's what? Like at the well, in this case it couldn't be because then you wouldn't have a stereo center. Because the geometry where the double bond is, that would be sp2, so it'd be planar. So this is the closest you could get a double bond to the stereo center. And there still be a stereo center there. Where the oxygen is? Yes, because you've got carbon that's double bonded, you've got an isopropyl group, you've got an oxygen, and you've got the hydrogen to that. So you've got four unique things attached to it. You make the phantom atoms out of it to then figure out which of those two groups is more important. So in fact,
let me rewrite that right now. We'll just solve the problem. So rewriting everything that's already a single bond stays exactly the same. The carbon-carbon double bond, we rewrite with a single bond. But all the other atoms that might have been are still there. Then on the left-hand carbon, since it was double bonded to a carbon, you write in an extra carbon. So now that you show that it had two connections. And on the right-hand carbon, because it was connected to a carbon, you're also going to put one of those doubling atoms in. Now let's look at priorities. From the stereo center, we go the first position out, and we can't make a determination there what's most important, because on the left-hand side, we have the two methyl groups, so there's two different carbons attached, which means there's a hydrogen left over. On the right-hand side, now that we've rewritten that double bond, it also shows two carbons attached. One of them's a phantom atom, but that's fine. And then another one's a real carbon. So we still have CCH priority. And so from that position still, we can't figure out the priority. So we do what we did in the other problem, go one more position out. When we go one more position out, now either direction I go, it's the same, so it doesn't matter which way I go. It's a methyl group, which means we only have hydrogen, hydrogen, hydrogen attached. But on the right-hand side now, when you have to go one more position out, you've always followed the most important chain. So we have carbon with a carbon attached versus just the phantom atom carbon. Since this chain is longer, it's going to have higher priority, so we follow it. Well, at that position, it's not hydrogen, hydrogen, hydrogen. Because of that phantom atom, it's carbon, hydrogen, hydrogen, which now we found the first point of difference. Carbon is more important than hydrogen, so the double bond, even though it's only two carbons, has higher priority than the isopropyl group. So, back to the original structure, oxygen priority 1, double bond priority 2,
isopropyl number 3, hydrogen still correctly oriented in the back. These go counterclockwise, so this is S. Yes.
This one?
Yeah.
Right. So if you look at what's attached here, there's the phantom carbon, and then there's the two hydrogens. Where over here, the methyl group, there's just three hydrogens attached. So that's the importance of that phantom atom. It gives a very systematic way of showing how important is that double bond. And you show it just by doubling the atom that's attached. Now, I'm guessing, because we just had the exam, we're just recovering from that, that many of you have not practiced RNS yet. Let me ask you, how many of you have done RNS practice at home on your own? A few of you. Okay, good. But about the same number of the other sections. So I'm going to make the same recommendation as I did to the other sections, just so that we can get through the rest of the topics for today. If I could ask that you do go home and practice it, and then we could do some more practice in class on Thursday. But I know that this phantom atom topic probably confused you, which is why I want you to have the time to go off and try it on your own, and then we'll practice more in class again. Sound like a plan? Yes? No? Did we have our caffeine this morning? Let's move on then, because we do have a few topics we really need to cover. First is a concept known as optical activity. We're going to talk about different kinds of stereoisomers. Up to this point, we've dealt with RNS and the fact there is such a thing as a stereoisomer, but now we need to figure out what these relationships are. So specifically, we're going to talk about enantiomers and diastereomers. We're going to talk about something known as meso. And then we'll barely have time at the end to mention this topic of racemization, which when we come back to lab, I'll try to expand on that a little bit. So optical activity. Enantiomers, kind of jumping a little out of order here. Enantiomers we've already seen. These are molecules that are non-superimposable mirror images of each other. So if you think back to the first lecture in stereochemistry that we did, I took methyl groups and put four different substituents on, three halogens and a hydrogen. And we saw that because we had tetrahedral geometry, there were two unique ways you can orient it, kind of like your left and right hands. Well, because these molecules are just mirror images, it turns out that all of their physical properties are exactly identical to each other, except for one critical property, which is the fact that opposite molecules will rotate plane polarized light in opposite directions. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, imagine this setup. Imagine that we have a light source. Let's say an old-style light bulb, which is going to give off light in all directions, but on top of giving off light in all directions, along the path that it's traveling, it may oscillate horizontally, it may oscillate vertically, it may oscillate at some other angle, or it can actually have a sort of circular oscillation that occurs. So light traveling all these different directions, we could then organize in some fashion by using what's known as a polarizer. So you notice the way that I've written these lines on the polarizer vertically. If you pass light through it, then only light that is oscillating vertically, will be able to pass through. So I'm trying to show here that it's in a certain plane orientation. Now imagine that we let it just keep on going
until it hit another polarizer. And let's say that that polarizer was oriented perpendicularly to the first one. And we'd observe whatever comes out. Well, if light were traveling only in one direction, oscillating up and down, and you tried to pass it through a polarizer that was crossed with it, that was orthogonal to it, none of the light's going to make it through. This is actually related to the technology that's used to make 3D films that don't require the goggles. Because what you have are two different panes of the glasses being oppositely polarized. Modern version is not linear polarization like this, but we could pretend it was for just the sake of discussion. So imagine one eye had polarization so it was vertical, one eye had polarization so it was horizontal. You'd project two images on the screen using a light source that itself is polarized these different ways. And so what ends up happening is if you project a light that is vertically polarized, but you look through your glasses, the one that's horizontally polarized, you won't see it. But the other eye that has the correct orientation will see it. And so that way the two different images, one of each only reaches one eye, and that's how you see in 3D. And if you take these style of glasses, take two of them, put them on top of each other, if you twist 90 degrees, it'll go black. If you twist another 90 degrees, it goes clear again, and back and forth, because of this cross-polarization effect. But what if the light did not just pass straight through? What if we had some kind of optically active compound? So we put in the middle here some kind of sample. So linearly polarized light is exactly what I've described here, where you have it oscillating in just one direction. And as it passes through something that's chiral, something that does have handedness, that light will twist either clockwise or counterclockwise. And so when it comes out again, it will be oscillating in some other direction, which I'm trying to show with a slanted plane here, showing that's now at an angle. And this is the property of optical rotation, which is how much twist occurs as light passes through the sample. Now, the further that the light passes through the sample, the more that it's going to twist. And so there is a quantity known as specific rotation that takes into account path length. But we're not going to be doing those kinds of calculations, and so I'm going to skim over that part. I'm more concerned that you just know what the physical property of optical rotation is. You could use a setup like this to measure it, though. You get the cross polarizers, and again, if there is no rotation, you should see dark if you have the polarizers crossed. If you had a chiral sample in between, you are going to have light that makes it through, so then you adjust the angle of the polarizers until you do make it go dark again. And then that's the extent of the rotation. So optical rotation is a twisting of plane polarized light caused by chiral materials. A clockwise rotation is given a plus sign, a counterclockwise rotation is given a negative sign. Now let me come back to that comment I made about enantiomers. And yesterday when I lectured about enantiomers, but as soon as I said enantiomers, I talked about optical activity. Today I want to talk about optical activity, but it doesn't make sense to, unless you can mention enantiomers, mention things that are mirror images. So coming back to that idea, again, if you have molecules that are mirror images, they'll have equal and opposite optical rotation. And sometimes, when you see the names of compounds in texts, instead of referring to R and S, they'll refer to plus or minus, particularly for biological molecules. So limonene, for example, a molecule that's found in lemons and limes. There's a plus version that has one kind of flavor or taste or scent, and there's a minus version. They're just enantiomers of each other, but they're quoted and listed and discussed as their plus and minus optical rotations. But let's say I had a molecule with just one stereocenter, and let's say that stereocenter was in the R configuration. You cannot, without some kind of sophisticated computer model, be able to determine whether that molecule is going to have plus or minus rotation. R and S are just, it's just a convention that we've come up with to be able to name molecules. But R and S itself, those labels, have no physical meaning. So there is no connection between R and S as a concept and plus and minus as a concept. The only connection would be is if you had a molecule with just one stereocenter, if it happened to be R and if it happened to be plus, then when you make the opposite, which means you're going to make an S stereocenter, because it's the mirror image, it's going to be minus rotation. So R and S are opposites, plus and minus are opposites, but R is not equated with plus or minus, S is not equated with plus or minus. Hopefully I said that clearly. I know that can be kind of a confusing one. But in other words, the way we name it and the way it acts physically have no connection to each other. So there is no connection between R and S and plus and minus, except that mirror molecules have opposite rotation. And let me add a comment here. If you have a mirrored molecule, then everything on original molecule that's an R is going to be an S when you take its mirror image. Everything that's an S is going to be an R. So that's what I'm trying to say here, that mirror molecules in which R and S are reversed have opposite optical rotation. So questions about optical rotation? Yeah.
Historically, we couldn't actually determine if something was R and S. In fact, that's a very important moment in carbohydrate chemistry. As Emil Fischer, from which we get the term Fischer stratification, Fischer projections, made a guess. He guessed that glyceraldehyde in one form, its plus form, had an R configuration. But because the physical properties are identical and they didn't have the kind of crystallographic techniques that we have now to be able to really determine what the structure of the molecule is, he just had to guess what it was. And he was able, by inference, to determine the relative structure, the relative stereocenters on a whole bunch of knew whether they were plus or minus rotation, and so when chemists described them, they quoted them as the plus or minus. In 1951, they finally got a crystal structure. then they knew that R meant plus for that one molecule. And every other molecule that they could make from that first molecule, they could then determine, oh, he guessed right. But if he had guessed wrong, then in 1951, the configuration of every molecule known would have been reversed. So in fact, when we come back later on carbohydrate chemistry, we're going to cover exactly that topic again. Now, one thing that came up in lecture in the other sections is that so far we've seen molecules and you've had to figure out if it's R or S, but I'd like you to try to write down the structure of S butane to all. Take 20, 30 seconds, see if you can go the other direction. And there's not one way to write it. There's at least four simple ways, and then there's even variations on that. Now notice in the name I didn't use a number in front of the R or S. That's because if you only have one stereocenter, you don't need the number. Because if you knew enough about structure to write the structure down, you'd recognize, oh yeah, there's only one place that I need to worry about. So, it's butanol, it's a four-carbon compound, that the alcohol group is on position 2. So you just have to make sure that when you write it, that if you use a wedge, for example, is that going to give you the rotation direction that you want? Which, yes, if you put it on the correct position, but actually not the way I've drawn it. The way I've drawn it, really there's only two choices. That whether I call the carbon in the middle on the left or the right, number 2, either position I put the OH group would have to have a dash, the way that I've done the zigzag. To verify that, we note that oxygen is priority 1, anything longer than a methyl is 2, a methyl is 3, and hydrogen is 4, but it's pointed at us, which means whatever we view has to be inverted. So it looks like it's R, but it's really S. But what if I did my zigzag like this instead? Effectively the mirror image. Well, then when you answered it, you could have answered it using a wedge. So both of those answers would also be correct. Again, we have priorities 1, 2, 3, which is S. For all four of those structures, you'd also have then the possible rotamers you could draw. So it was convenient to write all the carbons in the plane of the paper, but not necessary to. You could have put the OH group in the plane of the paper. But then either part of the carbon chain would have to have a wedge or a dash, or, well, there's a whole bunch of other possibilities. But when you're doing practice problems, make sure you do this style as well, going from the name to the structure. Now, let's move on. Oh my gosh. Running a little behind. Okay. Enantiomers. This is one class of stereoisomer. And this is one of the classic definitions you might have heard before, that these are non-superimposable mirror images. So exactly like those methyl derivatives that I showed you on the first day of stereochemistry.
One aspect or one relationship between enantiomers is something I mentioned earlier, which is that everything that's R on one version is S on the other.
So another way to define enantiomers is that all stereocenters are inverted. In other words, R is reversed with S. So let's say we had a relatively simple molecule. Is the stereocenter on the left R or S? S, oxygen priority 1, carbon with bromine and carbon priority 2, carbon with just carbon priority 3. Those go counterclockwise, so yes, it is S. How about the other stereocenter? Let's see. Bromine, priority 1. Carbon with oxygen and carbon, 2. Carbon with just carbon, 3. So 1, 2, 3. It looks like it's S, but which way is the hydrogen pointed? It's pointed out towards you. So it looks like S, but because it's backwards, it's actually R. Let's write the mirror image. The way that I wrote the mirror image on that first day was to imagine I put a mirror on the piece of paper and just reflect one side to the other. But if you're in a hurry, there's an easier way to do it. Flip all the wedges and dashes around. Since we're low on time, I'll just ask you verify this as part of your study. But if you did try to check it, you would find that the configurations have been flipped, that what used to be S and R are now R and S. Just to make sure that this was written down explicitly, all physical properties of enantiomers are identical except optical rotation. Which makes it hugely difficult to deal with enantiomers when you're doing a chemical reaction. If you make a product that's, let's say, a 50-50 mix of enantiomers, since the boiling point's the same, density is the same, polarity is the same, everything's the same, it's tricky to get them apart. Now, later on, we'll talk about strategies where you can use those to isolate different compounds. For the moment, let's go to the next class of stereoisomers, which are diastereomers. Now remember that both of these, enantiomers and diastereomers, are stereoisomers, which means that all the bond connectivity is exactly the same. It's just whether it is a wedge or a dash that's different. That's the only difference. Enantiomers are where all the stereocenters are inverted, so you have mirror images. Diastereomers are everything else. They're non-superimposable, non-mirror images. Which means that some, but not all, stereocenters are inverted. So imagine we had a compound like this with three fluorines on it. If I chose to flip two of them, it wouldn't be a mirror image. It would be a stereoisomer. but not all the R's and S's inverted. So it's a diastereomer. Since not all the stereocenters are inverted, that means the physical properties very likely and normally are different. They're not mirror molecules. They're totally different molecules in some sense. So diastereomers have different physical properties. There's a subset of diastereomers that you're going to encounter very frequently in carbohydrate chemistry, sugar chemistry. That's a type of diastereomer known as an epimer. It is a subset of diastereomer in which only one stereocenter has changed. So we can imagine even a simple alkane. We're out of, let's say, four stereocenters. Only one of them changes.
It's still a diastereomer, but the term epimer refers to the fact that only one position switched. There's a subset of epimer that I won't even write down yet, known as an anomer, which if you have had any biochemistry, you might have heard, for example, of the alpha and beta configurations of sugars. This is something that exists only when sugars are in cyclic form, and at that point where they become cyclic, a new stereocenter is created. Well, once we get there, we'll figure out that, well, the circle can be closed one of two different ways. Gives you two different stereoisomers, but the rest of the whole molecule is the same. And so that's a special case called an anomer, which is a subclass of epimer. But because it would take so long to show you the example and explain how to draw it, we're going to wait till we get to carbohydrates. So questions about enantiomers or diastereomers? Yeah.
Biochemically, but I would presume it's because of the way enzymes are. The enzymes have these reactive sites that only fit with certain configurations of molecules. So one mirror image would fit just like a glove would, the other mirror image wouldn't be able to fit in that place. And I presume it's something like that that makes one metabolizable and one not. Even something like the blood-brain pairing that protects the brain from chemicals that would otherwise be able to flow through the rest of the bloodstream, it's heavily specific as far as which enantiomer can make it through. Again, I assume that's just because of the shape interaction. Are there any people that have taken biochemistry that would be able to say something on that? I'll go ask one of our bio faculty members.
Let's go ahead and continue with that one lecture topic that we still had outstanding, which was on, is it chiral? And to get into discussion, I want to show you this molecule. So this is a molecule that does have stereocenters. Left-hand stereocenter, R or S? R. Any other one?
It looks like
It's actually S, yes, because 1, 2, 3, but the hydrogen's pointed out towards you.
So remember, you have to reverse what you see, and it's actually S. Notice what that means, though, in this specific case. Both carbons, both stereocenters, have exactly the same substituents attached to it. And they're in mirror image orientation. But that means that the whole molecule itself has an internal mirror plane. You may not be able to see it the way it's drawn, and in fact, this is a very classic trick question, this particular molecule. Because if you were to rotate the middle bond, like we were making a rotamer, we would more plainly see that the molecule has an internal mirror plane. Which means if you tried to make a mirror image of it, and we did it by imagining that there's a mirror on the paper itself, we're going to get exactly the same molecule out again. So this is a molecule that doesn't have enantiomers because the mirror image is itself. So this is a special case. This is something that is known as meso. And meso is a molecule that has stereocenters, but is not chiral. When you ask the question, is it chiral, what that means is there handedness? Is there multiple versions of this molecule that can exist? And with this particular set of configurations, no. There is no mirror image that's different. The mirror image is the same as itself. So instead of saying not chiral, the term we usually have is achiral. So meso refers to a molecule that has stereocenters, but is achiral. This occurs because there's an internal mirror plane of symmetry. Meso molecules will not be optically active because the direction that one of those stereocenters twists light is going to be exactly balanced by its mirror image stereocenter on the same molecule. Meso compounds are optically inactive. Since the optical rotation caused by one stereocenter is exactly balanced by the mirror stereocenter.
So let me write the four diastereomers. Well, actually, no, there's only three diastereomers of a molecule like this that has two OH groups.
Because ignoring what relationships do exist, we could choose to write the molecule such that the two OH groups are wedges, or the one on the right could be a dash, or the one on the left could be a dash, or we could make both of them dashes. So going from left to right, up or down, the relationships between each of these molecules, these would be diastereomers. Because between each one, only one stereocenter flips. And so, in fact, these could all be called epimers as well, since epimers are a subset of diastereomers. If we look at the upper left and lower right hand corners, if they're both wedges or both dashes, if you made the models for both of those, we'd find out they're the same molecule. Again, because there's this internal plane of symmetry. So it's really not two different molecules, it's just we've written the same molecule two different ways. The other pair, though, those really are mirror images. If you made the models for the other two corners and tried to overlap them, you wouldn't be able to. These are enantiomers. Brings up an interesting case. What you're talking about is a case like this. Where this molecule is meso, because there's an internal plane of symmetry. It happens to pass through one of the stereocenters itself. But is that center position a stereocenter or not? Because if a mirror plane passes through it, then you could say it's not a stereocenter. Except that what if I drew its cousin molecule like this, that also has an internal mirror plane? And so you could also make some argument that that center stereocenter is not a stereocenter. And yet, these are two distinct molecules if you did flip the configuration of that center. So that is what is known as a pseudo stereocenter. And we assign little r and little s to its configurations. The one in the middle of the molecule that the mirror plane passes through, and so you could argue, isn't really a stereocenter. But put a mirror plane through the molecule, and you can argue, well, since these two substituents are the same, how could it be a stereocenter? But these are two distinct molecules. So in a way it is, but in a way it isn't. That's why it's called a pseudo-stereocenter. This one? Well, this is the same one, just the opposite configuration, but exactly the same issue. Still a mirror plane. So if you're arguing on the case of symmetry, you'd say in both of these cases, they're both meso. But they have different configurations. Little r and little s, I need to check to see if it's in your textbook, though. If it's not, then we'll come back to exactly this situation, but once we've gotten through some of the simpler cases. Yeah. You have three different unique molecules is what you've got. Because these two are exactly the same molecule. And then these two are different from each other and different from this one. So this is kind of a unique set of relationships that you only have if you have a symmetry plane through the molecule itself. If you had something like this, then no matter which way the OH group and the BR group are oriented, it's always going to be chiral because there's never a mirror plane. You can have one center R, one center S, but because you have different substituents, they don't exactly cancel each other out across the molecule. So if you did the same thing where you drew both wedge, one dash, the other dash, both of them dash, those would be four unique molecules. And so in that case, you could say there's two pairs of enantiomers that are diastereomers of each other.